the Coach Rob Podcast, answering questions and eliminating frustrations about health, wellness, and performance since 1987.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Coach Rob Podcast Network. We're on another episode of Meet the Guest, Next Chapter. I am beyond thrilled to welcome Mr. Jeremy Martin to the show. For those of you who follow us in other segments of our business, I want to give you a little bit of background on Jeremy Martin. I personally had the privilege of working, we call him Germ for short, when he was riding 85s, and we'll talk briefly about how we got together and how he was getting dropped by Spencer Daly and Alex Martin on our big bike rides. And everyone was like, well, look at Jerm back there. And well, there was a little bit of a twist of fate when all that happened. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But Jeremy Martin, for those of you who are in the moto world, needs no introduction. But like I said, for those of you who don't follow moto, he's a two-time outdoor champion, back-to-back. Not many people are able to do that. I always say winning the first championships, not as difficult as defending it. We'll talk a little bit about that. He represented Team USA in what we call our Olympics of motocross. We call it motocross designations. He represented us twice there. He's got 20 outdoor wins. He's got 6 indoor wins. The amateur list is even longer is that. So I just can't tell you what a legend this guy is. And after you get done with today's conversation, you're going to see, yeah, lots of success. I'm very blessed. I have a signed copy of Racer X, where Jeremy was on the cover of it, racing for Star Yamaha. Like I said, I had the privilege of working with him when he was quite young. And then we circled back around when I was working with Dunge, and we were riding at the goat farm together. But I'll leave that introduction to itself. Jeremy, how you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing really well. Doing really well. Like, we just kind of talked before we got on the show. I just got back from Anaheim 1, doing the new gig. I was on Monster Energy Star Racing's Yamaha's VIP host. Nice. 2025. I guess Jimmy Dakotas has done it the last 2 years for them, and he decided to, have a family with Jamie.
So, okay.
We are no longer doing it, and I got a call, and I was like, hey, why not? So here we are, and now it's Monday, and you and I are ready to do an interview here.
Yeah. This is awesome. Well, you know, it goes without saying, the entire industry has missed seeing you. We're going to get into a little bit of the things that have kind of led you to that final decision. Very frustrating because you were in such great shape. And unfortunately, just one of those injuries that unfortunately puts a brake on the whole program. And we'll get into that here in a little bit. I want to give everybody just a 90-second background. Like I mentioned earlier, I had the chance to work with Jeremy when his dad put together a 3-man roster out of the Millville track. And Jeremy, well, did dad have a name for that? I don't know if he officially.
I just want to say it was like Spring Creek MX Racing Inc. or something like that. It was And like you said, we had Spencer Daly and then my brother Alex. And we all loaded up and kind of just traveled the circuit together and tried to make a go at it, didn't we?
Yeah,
had you as coach. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was awesome because I had never had a chance to meet Jeremy's dad. And if you know anything about Jeremy's family, his dad was a very successful racer in his own right. The pictures that I remember, Jeremy, that maybe dad won't like are the ones where he's leaning up against the Can-Am and he's got cowboy hat on and he's all, you know, looking all dapper and stuff. But Jeremy comes from a long pedigree of racers. Like you heard, he's got an older brother. How much older is Jeremy over, excuse me, Alex over you, Jeremy?
So I believe Alex is 35 right now, and I'm 31. So he's got a little bit on me.
Yeah. Just that typical 4-year span. So imagine an eighth grader trying to train and keep pace with a senior. That gives you an idea. So when Mr. Martin flew me up, and I'll never forget when he picked us up and drove us to your house, and I'm like, man, this is middle of the night. Your dad picked us up. It was a late flight. And, you know, the next morning we're out there and getting a chance to train on the Millville track with you guys. And, you know, obviously I have a fond appreciation for Spencer Daly introducing me to yourself, to your dad, obviously to Ryan Dungey and the whole nine yards, the whole Minnesota the clan, if you will. So I'm forever thankful. But I do want to share what I opened up today's conversation with. We went on a bike. The group of us went on a bike ride, and like typical brothers, right? Alex gave Jeremy no slack whatsoever. We're on a big bike ride. And if you know Minnesota at all, it's not flat. And I think we went for like 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours. And Alex is like, we're going to drop Germ. And Germ's back there just giving everything he's got. And again, remember, an eighth grader, I'm just using it for symbolic reasons. Think about an eighth grader trying to compete against a high school senior. Both are extremely accomplished racers, but cross-training wise, there's a big difference physiologically for
them. Oh, yeah, big time.
And Alex and Spence, they're just like putting the hammer down, and I'm kind of stuck in a quandary here. Do I try to keep pushing the guys to the front? And Alex is like, don't worry about it. Germ knows the way back. He'll get back. And we get back to the Millville track, and Jeremy's just in tears. He's so mad. Like, if you've ever gotten so mad at your brother, you want to kill him. And so the rest is history, because if you look at the way that the cards played out, Jeremy ended up being the first one to get a number one plate in the family. And I always tease my wife, Michaela. I go, I think those type of bike rides created a spark in Jeremy that I think a lot of people regretted, because they're like, where's this pit bull at? Well, it's getting dropped by your big brother and getting so mad you're pushed to the point of tears that you just want to tear someone's head off. So, but, you know, with all joking aside there, you remember when your dad built that track at the top of the mountain?
Oh, yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't dad have a jump go over the road that would go to the back of the mountain?
Yeah, so we had a road he built. We called it the road jump. And I remember that like it was yesterday, hitting that thing. And I'll let you finish the story. But yeah, it was crazy.
How far was that drop? Because you cased it that one time. And how far did you fall?
Yeah, I definitely flew quite a ways. It was, it was probably about I'd say 35, 40 foot gap, but just you're coming from one side of the hill, and then it was kind of like a step down, and it was a blind landing into an off camber kind of bull turn thing. I cased it, and right away I just broke my leg, and it was, that was definitely not a good day.
help me for those of you who do follow Moto, Jeremy, help them understand exactly where that track is at, because I would call it going up the hill, but there's a part of the race course that the amateurs don't see that only you expose for the pros. Was it not up that high? I think it was 20.
Yeah, so obviously we all kind of know like where Chad Reed famously crashed off to the side of that big, like we called it the Chatapult, right?
Yep.
So it just technically up above that is a spectator ridge. And then above that in the woods was our hybrid supercross track my dad built literally in the trees. And it was like, well, maybe that's not probably the smartest or best place to have a supercross hybrid track. But, I guess him being a hair scramble guy enthusiast himself and having an amazing career in that, I think he's like, well, this is fine. I don't see the risk in it.
But I don't think people understand. Literally, one of the jumps was over the road that was over 30 feet above the ground. So if you came up short, the cost was pretty big. And as Jerm just said, he got a broken leg out of it coming up short once. So I just never forget about, I'll never forget those types of stories. Your dad's hardcore. And I remember when you and Alex both were racing pro, and it was great because I was working with Dunge, and I remember walking through the tunnel with your dad, and it just brought back fond memories because, like you said, he's a legend in his own right. But
yep.
Walk us through, I think the majority of the people, and I've got some stories that I would love to talk about if we have time, and obviously if it fits into the conversation. But, one of the things that I always thought was interesting is like when you went to the Geico Honda team, and the one thing that comes to mind the most was like that summer that Jay Coop was on Star.
Yeah.
And you're riding the living snot out of the Geico, and it was very, very obvious that the Star was significantly faster. How does somebody like yourself, as hyper-competitive as you are, knowing that you're at such a disadvantage, how do you compartmentalize that? And again, this is for the listeners who constantly get put into situations of frustrations. They're always intrigued. How does someone like yourself overcome that, and only from a Jeremy Martin standpoint?
Yeah, well, I think you got to look back at the story. For me, like, obviously, my time with Star at that time was I won championships for them, and then, I was ready for a change. I think there were some gnarly rivalries going on there. And then when you, sometimes we don't always make the best decision throughout our career, right? But it was time for me to have a change in a new family. And I made the decision to go to Geico Honda. I mean, I'd seen Eli and Barsha and those guys have a ton of success. And I'm like, well, I'm ready to kind of find the new spark. I was a little bit... overtrained and just lacking that dog that I had in my championship years. And I went to Geico Honda, and you know, I think, like you said, the bike was maybe at a deficit a little bit, but and I knew that. And the thing about sport is, and what you learn throughout the journey is, especially motorsports, is nothing ever goes the way you envision it, and it's not perfect. And I knew that the bike was at a deficit, but we still have to line up every weekend and you have a job to do. And I was paid to win. And I think for me, I was always like, well, hey, I might be at a deficit here, but one, I have to be in better shape. I have to corner faster. I have to find ways to carry speed to make up for that lack of power. Like where the star bike, I think everyone can say is if the turns are really soft and you stuff the bike in the turn, that thing would get on the gas and get out of the turn faster than the Geico Honda would at the time. So I had to work harder. So therefore I had to be in better shape. And I think, I never really struggled to put in the work. I felt like for me, I enjoyed it, and I needed that to mentally be secure and solid for every situation across the board.
I go back to your dad, you know, everybody, like even Spencer's dad, you know, just a hard worker, salt of the earth.
Yeah.
I've even joked that I think sometimes it's in the Minnesota water, because I've never met somebody from Minnesota who just isn't afraid of the grind, whether that grind's on the bike, whether it's a grind off the bike, whether, you know, I think about your brother's story in the box van, you know, darn things breaking down all the time, but you just kept grinding until you get to the race and you don't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out.
Yeah.
It seems like there's something in that Minnesota blood. How much of that grit and determination would you give, and maybe as a percentage or any way that you'd like to describe it, how much of that comes from you within? How much of it was exemplified by your dad? How much of it was, for the lack of better terminology, you know, kind of beat into you from the standpoint, like this is the way it is. There's no exceptions.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of everything. I think number one, it's really cold in Minnesota, like in the winter, right? So like, yep. You kind of got to be hardy and tough in general, right? Like, you know, if you want to do an outdoor hobby and go snowboarding or whatever, it's pretty cold. And I don't know about you guys, but people don't really like the cold.
Right.
So I think that kind of makes you tough. And then my dad was pretty gnarly growing up. Like he was, you know, we never really had family dinners, if that makes sense. Like we would eat and then he would just go back to work. He'd come in late, he'd be working all the time because he had Spring Creek Motocross. So I think I learned from a young age, and now as I'm older, I really realize I got my work ethic, I think, from my dad. And because nothing was ever good enough and we were constantly improving Spring Creek Motocross. And I think that really kind of like bled over into my career. And then also I think being kind of OCD, I guess, in a sense, I kind of like I could do the same thing over and over and over. And like, that's kind of how my dad was, is like, and picking it apart and analyzing it and trying to see what you could do to be better. And I think you almost have to have that type of obsession in sport to be that, because only it's 1%, right? The 1% win. There's going to be one 450 champion in 2025 and one 250 champion outdoors. Well, two 250 champions, that's still. So with that being said, my point being is that to be that 1%, you're so good at that one area that I think you almost, your relationships and other things in life start to suffer. And I think a lot of people attest to that. There's times where you're borderline, you don't have that balance, but you want to win that bad that you're willing to sacrifice everything around you, you know?
You mentioned the idea that you were with Star and then you chose to go to Geico. I don't know if you're comfortable or at liberty to talk about it, but was that 100% your decision? How much did you consult with your dad? Like, there's a lot that had to be factored in. I think most superficial people go, oh, it was all about money. You know, putting money aside, because that's not what this show is about. And I'm always amazed by that. You know, what is it, like you said, you knew you were going to a platform that maybe wasn't as fast. I know that Ziggy's a great guy. You've got Grundle over there. There's just that team at Geico was phenomenal. But from a decision standpoint, I think it's very, very intriguing. what were the, again, only what you're comfortable with, what things did you have to factor in that made, or what did you choose to factor in that made you say, yep, I know you mentioned a new environment. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Like, what is it you were looking for when you say a new environment?
Yeah, well, I think I've been with STAR. I mean, they gave me an opportunity in 2012, and that was I was an amateur that year. And then I ended up dislocating my shoulder at Loretta's. So I wasn't able to do Loretta's for them, but I ended up doing the last two outdoor nationals, and I was terrible. My shoulder was jacked and I just wasn't good. But 2013 was my first full season. So I did 13, 14, 15, and 16 with STAR. And, you know, I had some of the best years of my career. And I also, you know, had some really rough times with them. And I just think that the relationship had kind of taken its course at that time. I think, you know, the negotiation side of things, I'd hired an agent at the time. And I think that there's a little bit of pushback from that. And then I think, you know, I felt like I'd kind of earned my stripes to maybe get a little bit of a better deal, as you could say. And I felt like it was deserved. And there's a little bit of pushback there. And I think the rivalry between, I guess you could say Coop and I at the time, which I'm actually so grateful for now. And I spent a lot 25 minutes talking to him on Friday, after press day at Anaheim. But yeah, I think the rivalry was pretty gnarly, and Swanee being the team trainer and stuff, that was a little difficult on me. And I just think that there was a combination of things, and I definitely, you know, confided in my mom and dad. I mean, at the time I was just a spring chicken, and you're making this massive decision, you know what I mean? And I felt like Geico was really aggressive and they wanted me, and that felt good, you know? And it just seemed like they were willing to do whatever it took. And I got a tour of the facility and everything. And I felt like their resume and who they had on their team and whatever, it was a good decision, you know?
Sure, that makes sense. I don't want to get too far over our skis here. That was going to be one of my questions for you. And while you brought up Jay Coop, I'll just ask it now. Obviously that summer, you and Jay Coop are going back to back. The catalyst for your injury was running into him in the air when you hurt your back. Who got you out of bed? Who motivated you to get out of bed? I was going to ask for five riders. I was going to assume Coop would be somewhere in that mix, but who would be the four of the riders that motivated you to get out of bed every morning?
You know, that was really hard on me. That was like kind of, I don't think I was ever fully the same J-Mart after that back injury.
Absolutely.
And I never moved like even still to this day, I have the hardware in my back. I don't move normal. And like, I notice in really hot conditions, I'm not quite the same and whatnot. But I think, yeah, I was pretty bitter for a long time. And I felt like, you know, Jay Coop was definitely a motivator. And then, I really questioned whether or not I wanted to come back even at that point because it was so gnarly. I went septic. I was on antibiotics for over a year. I had a PICC line in my arm, and then it didn't heal in 6 months. So then I had to go back and get another surgery at the Stedman Clinic in Vail to get it fixed. So I missed all of basically 2019 because of a mistake that was made in Tennessee from that emergency surgery, essentially, right? So
yeah,
there's a lot of things, man. And I think I had a lot of obviously downtime, as I kind of gave you the outline of that injury. And I was scared. I'm like, well, I'm young. I don't know if I want to go back out there and take the risk. But then I was like, don't make an emotional decision. And I went and got a job at that Vice Cycle place. And I was just like, you know, I said, just pay me X amount of minimum dollar, and I need to get out of the house and stay busy. And through kind of doing that and realizing how lucky I was to be a professional dirt bike racer, and the hunger grew back. And it was, I read some stuff. Like, I remember David Goggins, reading the book of David Goggins and reading some other mental motivational books and stuff. And I think that slowly started to ignite the fire, you know, and that kind of came back and be like, well, hey, what if I can come back? And what happens if I can come back and I can win in the first year? What's that say?
Yeah.
How cool would that be?
Absolutely.
And I kind of changed my mental mindset, and that kind of, And I was able to come back, and I was really, really good that year outdoors.
Was there an epiphany that made you come to that, or did somebody bring it to your attention when you said you had that kind of that attitude adjustment, perspective change?
I think being in the dealership and like realizing like kind of what real life was like, you know, and then I think the dog came back in me once I got healthy and I started doing therapy and whatnot. And I'm like, I ain't done yet. You know, I ain't done yet. And I have a lot of fight in me still.
That's awesome. Yeah. When you were doing the dealership thing, didn't you start a video vlog and you were talking about, hey, these boots are expensive and people were, isn't that when you started your video blog?
I think I started, Alex started the vlog first and then I came a little bit later. But yeah,
okay.
Regardless, I did do a social media post like the Dolly Parton working 9 to 5, this kind make a living. So yeah, and I saw obviously how expensive stuff was, and I was like, oh, damn.
Yeah, it's been a few sunsets that you purchased boots or bought a bike, right? So, and that's a good thing. I want to, just out of curiosity, and again, if I ask anything that you're not comfortable, please, by all means, you're not obligated. Did anybody in the industry reach out to you that really was a game changer for you? Somebody that maybe had been through with something similar to what you'd been through that really you're so appreciative of to this day?
Yeah, I think like I was in talks with like Trey Kennard, obviously. And then at that time I was training with Eli, you know, and Eli was there for me. Alex was there. I mean, I had a lot of really nice, good people kind of reach out to me and stuff. And it definitely helped me quite a bit for sure. I think, you know, I've been very fortunate that way. You know, I've worked with you, and I worked with, you know, just a lot of people, the Carmichaels, Matt Walker, I worked with Rhino. I think getting an education, you know, is a big thing. Like I see a lot of people kind of just go to one training facility and kind of live and die by that. But and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I think there's something to be said for trying. You can learn a little bit of something from everyone.
Absolutely.
And when you're at the top level of the sport and you try to be there for a long time, things arise and things change. And you have to be comfortable kind of, you know, with the change and whatnot, you know?
Yeah. And I'm going to rip a scab off. And again, if it's too painful, I understand it. How in the hell did you manage going from, and we're going to talk about you leading Daytona. And I may be wrong. I'm just a spectator. I'm still a big fanboy of the sport. On the outside looking in, it looked like you were the next heir apparent for that 450 ride at Factory Honda.
Yeah.
And then unfortunately we had that day where you and Coop came together, broke your back, and the rest is history. How in the world do you bridge your phone's ringing off the hook, interviews left and right, cover of RacerX magazine. Every time you go online, you're somewhere, whether it's in an ad, you're in the magazine, the print magazine, you're online in some capacity, some conversation to crickets. How in the world do you file that?
I mean, it's definitely tough, man. It's tough. I went from, you know, growing up and I wasn't really a chosen one, right? Like I was just a fat little chunky kid that, you know, like to be fair, I just wanted to ride dirt bikes because my brother was doing it and Spencer Daly was doing it at the time, you know, and they were my teammates. And I just wanted to be like them. And then, you know, all of a sudden I got pretty good. And then, you know, you start winning and then everyone wants to be on the bandwagon. And then, you know, you try to stay true to who you are and you let a couple people in. And then sometimes when stuff goes astray, you kind of see some cracks. And I think you kind of realize, you know, like when I was in the hospital with my back, I realized nobody was going to come get me out of that bed. You know what I mean? I sat in the hospital for about a month, you know, and you know, nobody, my family was running Spring Creek. So they couldn't be there with me. There was a lot of days I spent just staring at the ceiling tiles in the hospital. So it was pretty rough. It was very rough. And I realized nobody's going to come and save you. And you have to fight for what you want. You have to fight. And that was a really big thing for me, Coach Rob.
How old were you when you had that back injury?
I was, that's a good question. 26. Yeah.
I like for the listeners to kind of put that in perspective. You know, when we're 20, we think we've got life by the groin. We know what's going on. then you're 25 laying there. And it, for the people who didn't see the nature of the accident, I don't know if I'll be allowed to show it in the video as a B-roll or not. I don't know if it's copyrighted or not, so I don't know if I'll be able to show it. But would you mind sharing with the people who don't follow moto, what were the extent of your injuries?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing was is I collided with Jay Coop, and I was like, oh no, in the air. I was like, dude, I'm dead.
You that know? GoPro video was brutal. I mean, to actually see you come together and hit the ground, that was brutal.
Yeah, I was like, oh man, I was like, I think I'm dead, you know? And like, this ain't going to be good. And then I remember like kind of waking up, you know, and then wiggling my toes. And I was like, all right, I'm all right. I have feeling there. And that to me was like, that was always one of my biggest fears, man. I'm not sure. I was like, snakes is one of my biggest fears.
Hey, man. How was you?
Getting paralyzed, you know, and that was a really big thing for me. And I was obviously that close to doing it. And I sustained an L1 burst fracture.
Okay.
Through my, my middle of my back there. I'm lumbar. And it was crazy.
And what year was that when you came together with Jay Coop?
It was 2018.
It was 18.
Yep. Okay. And then my first year back was with Geico was 2020, which ended up being, unfortunately, the last year of Geico Honda.
The whole Geico squad, yeah. And we won't get into why that team folded. That's getting into bench racing and politics that this show's not about. So when you, if we kind of, just for, again, for the sake of people who are maybe a little bit not aware of moto, what would you say was your significant, in the most significant injury you had when you were riding for Star before the back injury, just to kind of put it in context of what you've had to overcome?
I guess with Star, like I fractured my arm, but I didn't really need any surgery. And then I broke a toe at Motocross Nations and I had to get a screw put in there. But I was relatively pretty injury free, I guess you could say, for the most part until I was on Geico Honda, you know, and then it really kind of started to snowball from there. But I guess the biggest thing I could say is the level I was at, when you sustain an injury, there's so much downtime and things that you miss, and that really affects your career, and it takes a lot of work to get back to that. And I think I've been a pretty good example of that, especially the last little bit of my career here.
I would 100% agree, and I would say 100.00 of the listeners would say the same thing. You've always been known as the grit and determinator, you know what I mean? And that's why I use you quite often in whenever I do performance camps, is I use you as an example, because whenever I did research on your career, I couldn't find a lot of, you know, injuries. I mean, yeah, broken arms, no fun, but like I say, it wasn't like compound fracture, spiral fracture, tib fib or something like that. And I always try to get the young athletes to understand the value of being strong and flexible is prehab to avoid those big hits. Yeah, we're going to have them. And the faster you go, the harder you hit. But why wait till you're broke? You think about it, we go do rehab and we do physical therapy versus get strong and flexible. You've always been a good example of that. I never like to use the B-roll, but when people see some of the get-offs that you've had, it's not like you're walking across the street, right? I mean, it's big falls, fast speed. Like when you guys allowed me to ride the 450 around Spring Creek, I was butt-puckered the whole time. I'm like, until you ride that track, I don't care to anybody, especially being from Florida, where our total elevation is about 11 inches, and that's called the curb, right? And then you go up to the Chatapult and you go up to those. And I just remember looking at the takeoff and like, you can't see where you're going to land. And then as soon as you land, you're on the binders, left-hand turn and straight back downhill. And I just remember going, this is insane. And then to add speed and something goes wrong, just like the Chatapult, thank goodness he landed on the side of that. But that's why I wanted people to understand you didn't have a laundry list of injuries. Then you run into Jay Coop in the air. Like you said, you wake up, you find yourself obviously in just a world of hurt. What were the magnitude of those injuries? We know the spine. Did you have any other broken bones outside of the spine?
No, I was very fortunate from that perspective. It was just the spine, which is obviously the bones to the operation. I mean, that's a pretty vital part, but
absolutely.
You know, I obviously got knocked out and whatnot, but just the head and then obviously the back, that was the biggest thing. But kind of going back to what you were saying, that definitely kind of, I was a slot, I think, to get that factory 450 ride. And, you know, I actually had one I had a deal lined up with RCH.
Oh, really?
Back in the day, too, to go 450.
With Kenny, or to replace Kenny?
Like Vaughn Casino or whatever it was.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. I had that done up actually before I was going to go, because when I left Star, I was kind of wanting to go 450 at that point already.
Sure. You know?
And they were going to give the spot to Webb over me, because he had the Supercross. And that was always my kryptonite, hey? Like, and I felt an immense amount of pressure. I proved that I could win outdoors. I was your guy. Like, I proved it. But I never got that monkey off my back of Supercross. And I'd won races.
Yep.
But I hadn't put together a season to say, hey, we're going to invest in this all-star A450 guy. And Webb did an amazing job of that. And he delivered. And he got that gig. And I ended up going to, I was RCH. I was going to do it. But they ended up losing the title sponsor. So then I was ended up going back to, I went to Geico Honda then, you know, and I was excited. I was having a great year. Probably one of my best years on Supercross. And then I think I was a shoo-in to definitely be first or second in the championship that year. It was AP and I, we were having a battle. And then I obviously hurt my back, and then I lost that 450 ride. And I think it went to Chase. And that was a big turning point kind of in my career for sure.
When you talk about going and riding for RCH, would that be teammates with Roczen?
Yeah. I mean, I would have been right there on the factory Honda, you know. I mean, that I remember riding that thing at Daytona in Round Ball. I mean, that thing was like,
and that's when Kenny was still on Honda.
Yeah. Kenny had that big accident, and that problem was able to fill in at Daytona. And yeah.
And then going to ride for Ricky's team, was that in lieu of Roczen going there or Webb going there?
Well, I think
I just want to clarify
going to Honda, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go back to that Star Yamaha, and you're talking about being your kryptonite. I remember hearing a story. You could tell me if it's true or not. I remember hearing a story. I want to say it was Atlanta.
Yep.
And it was that right hand. They come across the start line. I think that's where Alessi took out Tickle, just completely obliterated him when Tickle was on Suzuki. And if I remember right, your bike was so fast, you couldn't keep the front end down, and you couldn't get an intro into the Woots worth a hill of beans, and you didn't qualify that night. Am I correct?
Yeah, I did not qualify.
And then I understand you went back to the pits, and they packed that rig up and left you literally in the parking lot with sitting there.
I mean, it was definitely like I didn't qualify at the first round or the second round. And it was like, you know, I was getting paid good money to basically win. Like, I should have been the guy. And I failed my team, you know, and they were all about winning and whatever it took. And to be fair, they had every right to kind of do it. But I came back, and there was a lot of really gnarly discussions and meetings that went down, and basically it resulted in me getting in the van with my trainer at the time, Dylan Turner, and we drove out west to California, and we lived out there, and we trained with Coop, and you know, they watched us day in and day out, and then we were able to kind of turn it around, you know. And but yeah, that hurt. That one really, really hurt. That was like, I thought my career was over.
Well, and that's why I appreciate being willing to share. And again, I don't want to expose anything that you're not comfortable with, but
yeah.
I don't think the typical listener fully understands how nasty those meetings, and when I say nasty, take it with a grain of salt, how nasty those meetings can get when the door's closed. You know, it's like, oh, great, you're a factory rider. And I remember when I was working with Ashley Feilich, and she was factory Honda. And I remember Ashley, in her typical form, got the start. And then JP Money, Jessica Patterson, ran us down. And I remember that Monday morning meeting, right? You walk into corporate Honda. Literally, it's like a movie scene. You know, the double doors closed behind you. Huge conference table. There's 100 number one plates around the roof. There's RC's Works 250 sitting in one corner. You got Duhamel's road racing bike in the other corner. And man, did the shit hit the fan, because we got beat.
Yeah.
I was just like, I got goosebumps. I'm like, this is the shit that you read about, where it's not like, oh, Jeremy, you're such a great person, we think you've got what it takes. It's like, and I'm going to let you finish the story.
What do those conversations look like? Job threatened?
I think so, right? Like, I mean, obviously, like I said, there's a lot of money and there's a lot of work. These guys, the mechanics, the engine builder, the owner, these guys spend a lot of money to get these rigs going down the road.
Yeah.
And, they pay the riders when they win a lot of money and they expect them to do a job. And there's absolutely no excuses to not make a main event. And then it's only a matter of time before they definitely put the hammer down on you, right? And like, I obviously had a lot of great moments in my career, but there was a lot of times where, you know, I didn't have, you know, I mean, I lost more than I won, you know what I mean? And it's, that's the kind of the beauty of sport is you're only as good as your last race. And even if you're the champion that year, dude, it doesn't matter. There's another year. There's a new year.
Right around the corner.
New opportunities and a chance to go from being the underdog and to being the loser to the winner.
What year was that when you didn't, that was your first year with Star when you didn't qualify for the first two mains? What year would that have been?
So I didn't qualify in 2013. I was here at Bass's qualifier in Dallas and practiced on the carbureted bike.
Yep.
And then the second year I didn't qualify, I think it was the first two mains, I thought. I could be wrong, but yeah. So it was gnarly.
When you're leaving the, you know, obviously you're the laughing stock, right? Didn't make the main event. It's going to be all over social media. Obviously social media wasn't then what it is now, but still people, they get behind a keyboard. Everyone's a badass behind a keyboard. Who in the world did you go and hide behind, hug, cry, talk, laugh, scream? Who was that tight knit group that, because how old would you have been at this year at that age? Excuse me, Eric. That,
I mean, I was pretty young. I was 21, 22.
And so
I
put that in perspective. 21, yeah, making like good money.
And my parents were away. My parents kind of really raised me like, hey, when you're, you know, when I was 16, 18, you know, and then even when I want, they had Spring Creek. So they raised me to be very independent. They said, hey, you're a big boy. This is your contract. This is on you. And like my mom and dad came to some races, but they weren't like, there was no pacifier. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's like I won my first championship and my dad wasn't there, but my mom was. So it was very like, that kind of puts it into perspective, right? So yeah. I very much had to grow up from a very young age. And
You're 21, making good money, expected to win. Like you say, getting money that comes along with the expectation of being a champion. You don't qualify. And I want to say it was Atlanta was the first one, because I just remember that right-hand turn going into the whoops. Where's your headspace? You feel like a loser? Do you feel like these guys don't know what they're talking about? Was it the bike and you're arguing for setup and you couldn't get it? What was it?
I think so. I remember practicing. I had a relatively stock engine that whole offseason. And then they came out with the new engine.
The new EFI, right?
Which was just insane.
Okay.
And I just remember being really, really uncomfortable. And I always lacked a little bit of confidence in Supercross. So could I go really fast? Yes. Once I was comfortable and I knew the track. But to just show up cold turkey, go out, hammer the track, and then feel confident. I always struggled there, Rob, with that stuff. So I felt defeated. I was broken. You know, like, you know, you're on the edge. And I remember, dude, my back is against the wall. I have nowhere else to go, but like, it's just, you either get this shit figured out or you're done.
Yeah.
Career over. And
had you ever been in that situation before?
Not to probably that level.
Okay.
But I mean, yeah, there was times where like I had an amazing B amateur year and, you know, the phone wasn't ringing at the end of the year. And my dad's like, hey, dude, Alex was a privateer as a professional. And he goes, this stuff's really expensive and I can't sustain two kids.
Sure.
To do this. He goes, like, you just had the best year of your career and nobody's calling.
Why do you think that was? Just out of curiosity.
And I'm like, he's like, you know, maybe it's time to move on. And I said, dude, I can't. I just couldn't do it. And then, you know, last minute, Yamaha called. Donnie Luce from Yamaha called me. And he gave me some bikes and I rode it for 15, 20 minutes. We built a bike in Minnesota. The ground was frozen. I rode And then we loaded up and drove down to Minneapolis. And dude, I just went on this crazy rampage of winning, and then even when I was it was supported by Star, but I had to basically win to get a contract.
Okay.
A professional contract, yes.
Yeah. Yep. You had to win Loretta's to get that contract.
Well, I remember I got injured that year, but I absolutely dominated the Spring Nationals.
Yes, sir.
And then I got really lucky and I was able to get a deal. Okay. I was very lucky that way.
And I appreciate you elaborating on that, because I think a lot of people are not aware how these contracts are penned up, where it tends to be an all or nothing. Like, you know, getting that first first pro contract, you hear so much about, okay, if you're top five or top three, it's an automatic renewal, maybe a 10% increase or whatever. Correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the contracts, win the championship, your salary doubles for the next year. Mm-hmm. I've heard that a couple different times. Why do you think back at the amateur level when you won that year, why do you think the phones weren't ringing? Is it just the musical chairs and what's available, or didn't play the politics? What do you think kept you back?
We were always pretty reserved, as far as like, we weren't always up in there like calling and trying to network. And I think that plays a, politics is a big thing.
Sure.
And I think that there's a lot of kids that get groomed from a young age that were on the Team Green program, and back when Suzuki had a big program, they try to bring you up through the ranks, and then, you know, they kind of already have people picked. And I was like a guy that broke out later.
Yeah.
And that's kind of rare. That's definitely rare. And I think you would agree.
Absolutely. Well, and I think this, not to get on the subject of training, because that's not what the show's about, but I think it does show all the sweat equity that you'd put in the years before. That's the hard part with fitness, is you don't see what you did today for 6 months. That's the physiological number. The body you're sitting with today is a byproduct of the exercise and the food that you've eaten 6 months to this day.
Yeah.
And when you do that, I call it stacking. When you stack two or three successful seasons together, the athletic maturity and the physical development is not, it's not visibly seen until you see it in what we refer to as athletic poise. When you see someone's body language, I think this past weekend you saw it with both Tomac and Sexton. Their body language gave a completely different message than what we saw from Jet. Jet not comfortable with the bike. Obviously, Tomac being on a Yamaha 2 years now, Sexton seems to get, has gotten the bike figured out a little bit better. See the difference in the body language. And like you were saying, here you are, you've got so many years. When you went on that rampage, it was a lot of deposits. Now you're taking a lot of withdrawals.
Yeah.
I just think it's interesting, you know, from that standpoint. When you go back in the timeline, so you come out of Loretta's, like you said, you got hurt, you went and did the two outdoor nationals, you kind of got a banged up wing. So not the best performances that you were happy with. When did you finally get the shoulder back? And did you know that, all right, I'm back to what I know I'm capable of? In your brain, like if we were to draw it on a piece of paper, what caused the switch on the wall to flip, to go from I'm not sure to, oh, hell yeah, I'm on this?
I think for me, it was all about a feeling. I mean, it was 2013. I sucked in Supercross. I think I got a podium at Daytona, and like that was amazing, right? Yeah. And then I really kind of caught my stride halfway through that outdoor season. On that 250 in 2013, I almost won a moto against Tomac. That year he was kind of like beast mode created.
Yep.
He like jumped over me going down the hill, and I'm like, oh my God, dudes, you know? And I absolutely like blew myself apart in Moto One trying to win that thing. And I was smoked for Moto Two.
Yeah.
But I think I finally had a year under my belt. I got a lot more fit. I found out what I could eat on race day, did not piss my stomach off and things like that.
Sure.
And honestly, Coach Rob, I really attested to, it was a perfect case scenario. I was nervous about Yamaha coming out with this new bike and whatnot, and they weren't going to get parts until late, right before the race season, for the race motor and stuff. And then they did. I struggled in Supercross, and then I was able to kind of like get it together. And I remember like riding the bike outdoors, and all of a sudden I was just turning like I could never turn. And I was doing 40-minute motos, and I was so consistent in my times, and I could actually with like 5 to 10 minutes to go, I could go faster than I could in the beginning. Cause I always had a hard time opening up fast, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah. And I think it kind of really clicked for me, and Baggett was the guy that year. And, I didn't believe in myself. I was like, hey, I just want to be a top five guy. And I came out and I said, fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm lying. I said, hey, you work just as hard as everybody else. You deserve this just as much as they do. You put your pants on the same way they do. You know?
I love that. And you hear that quite often where there's just something that flips the switch on the wall. And that's what always intrigues our listeners is, what is it? You know, I always say, if we could bottle up when you go down, the fear of going down, all right, it's manifested itself. And then you get up and you're, let's say somebody cleaned you out. You're so irritated. You ride with no fear, not thinking, just WFO literally. And you're like, okay, well then how do we bottle that up so that before the gate drops, you have that same FU attitude where I'm going to the front no matter where I'm at. After you fall, you see people ride to their fullest potential. And I think that's always the $1 million question. And that's kind of the genesis behind this show is, what is it that flips the switch? And we go, okay, perspective change. I've put in the sweat equity. I've put in the work. It's go time. It's like, but it's been sitting in you for 18 months, but now just, again, only for the sake of illustration in the tongue in cheek, you know, if your dad bitch slaps you upside the head and it irritates you to the point that you're like a pissed off hornet, well, then maybe you get slapped in the head before everyone just because we know it works. Now, again, I'm using that as a figurative field and cheek example.
Well, I think, Rob, it kind of comes down to people are focused on the result. Mm-hmm. Think about in the off season, right? Like if you're in the gym and someone's strong, you know, they're lifting a certain number. They're bench pressing this. They're doing so many pull-ups. It's a result, right? The stopwatch, it's a result. Everything is a result. And I think, you know, there's only one guy that wins. There's a guy that gets second, a guy gets third. And I think what happens is when you hit the deck or someone takes you out, you let go of the result. And you're focused on just, I'm going to do this. I'm focused on the process, right? And I think that's something that I even struggled with a big time in my career, right? Is being in the moment. You can't control the outcome. But what you can control is, you know, what you choose to focus on, your mindset. And then, you know, you go into a first turn, for example, like Anaheim won this weekend, like Jet went in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you got, you know, those metal grates. Everyone's going into the first turn faster than ever. Everyone's got a whole shot device and starting maps. You can't control what's going to happen.
Sure.
But why worry about it? And I think there's something to be said when you do go down and someone takes you out, you're pissed off and it changes the mindset.
Yeah. All of that you just articulated, how much of that was taught to you from outside mentors and how much of that was that just experience creates that kind of a mindset all the way around?
I think that kind of comes from just the 10 years that I raced, right? And I think I was really in my head pretty gnarly the last, from 2022 on. And then I actually saw a mental performance coach because I could feel it kind of slipping a little bit.
Sure.
And he really kind of really showed me that, you know, and I think it opened my mind and my perspective. And I'm able to kind of tell you that in an educated kind of way now versus where before I think I knew, but I couldn't explain it the way I did.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're very fortunate. We work with Denise Hatch with Power of the Mind, and we say what she does is the glue that puts it all together. You can put in the sweat equity, you can put in all the skills and drills, but that mental muscle, it does tend to lag behind in regards to physical development, right? You do enough bicep curls, you go from 30s to 40s to 50s. It's pretty straightforward. But yeah, that mental muscle, it's all the intangibles that you can't measure. I always call it the slippery C word, confidence, you know, because 1 minute it's there and then it can evaporate literally in the drop of a button. Majority of things that you really can't control. And so I think that that's huge. I know we've alluded a couple times to the Daytona ride on the 450. Walk us through, you know, you're having a good summer. You're ripping it up on the 250. Obviously, you know, bar to bar. I mean, that whole summer watching you and Jay Coop, it was just awesome. Cause like you said earlier, I felt like you were riding at a level that, selfishly because I have an affinity towards you, having the privilege of working with you for a while, I always enjoyed watching you. And then when we could tell that the bike was underpowered, as you said earlier, you had to do everything better, more aggressive. You had to open the track up, et cetera. I thought it was more enjoyable. You got to really see what J-Mart was all about.
Yeah.
How did that have that conversation look with going to the 450? Because as we said earlier, it was pretty obvious. You're the next big guy coming through the Geico program. Looked like the musical chairs was working out that 450 opportunity was going to come. And then you get to Daytona. How did that have that come about? Was that part of the game or was it just an opportunity that came up?
It was kind of just an amazing opportunity. Like the 2018 Daytona 450 race, like Ken was hurt. Cole Seeley was the guy. And to be fair, I kind of had like a really terrible, it just worked out. Like Lucas Myrtle kind of lined it up for me.
Okay.
And it was perfect case scenario. And I was kind of trying to ride that to kind of showcase my my ability a little bit to try to get a 450 ride.
I always say luck is where hard work meets opportunity. So here you are. You've been doing all these years of work. Your skill sets are obviously unbelievable. Your mental mindset's tough. And then the opportunity comes. And say, oh, but you got lucky. No. Luck's where hard work meets opportunity, but you got to be ready for it.
That's very true. That's very true. You know, it's, you spend your life trying to get to this point, right? To become a professional. And then you look at somebody like Chase. I feel like Chase physically has really kind of come into his own. And we saw that as last year on Honda. And then you kind of, I also made this mistake too, a little bit in my career. You get to a point to where you're so mentally strong and you feel so good. You feel like I can overcome this. So he went to KTM the first year and he's like, well, I'm good enough. I can overcome this. Well, the reality of it is like, yes, you can, but you also have to learn new personnel. You have to learn a new motorcycle. You may be able to be good on it during the week, but what about on race day when you have Honda, Kawasaki, Suzuki, Yamaha all riding it? All these different caliber of riders making different ruts and going this way and that way. That's a whole new perspective on how to set a motorcycle out.
Absolutely.
But it's not just a test track where it's all Yamaha and everybody rips the same, kind of rides the same lines or setups, whether they have races in the bike or not. I mean, there's so much that kind of goes into it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you go out to Daytona, if I'm not mistaken, you led all but what, the last four laps?
Well, I think I led till about halfway, and then the old ET3 monster came through. I got pretty tired. The tongue was in the spokes.
So and what was it?
Just insane that year. Remember, he gave Dungey a fit for the title.
Yeah.
And he might have had it if he didn't have that tip over. Maybe it was up near New York or something like
something
that.
Like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just like, frick, man. You know, you couldn't just let me win in.
So what was it like? Again, all of us can only live vicariously through what we saw on TV. I remember I was jumping up and down screaming. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like, it's like the perfect story coming together, because obviously, you know, you're watching musical chairs and you've had the two back-to-back, you know, championships. So you know how to win races, which I think is something that's a lot of people underestimate. There's a process to winning a championship. There's an additional process to repeating a championship. People don't understand that. But putting that aside for just a moment, walk us through what kind of emotion, like, are you having a parent-teacher conference with yourself? Like, holy shit, I am leading this 450. Or are you just so in the moment, you don't even have headspace to think about it?
I mean, I definitely thought, I was like, holy shit, I'm winning this thing. Like, no, this is gnarly. Like, I literally went to the LCQ.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then I was on the outside of the start. And actually, you know what I was thinking, Rob? This was 2017. This was the first year I was on Geico Honda, and I remember I did West Coast that year, that only year in 250, and I shit the bed. And then Kenny got hurt, you know? And that's how I got that fill-in, because 2018 was the new chassis of a 450 in 2017. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm going to have a good year in 2018. This is a lot better, this chassis.
I love just like that right there. Like when you have that aha moment where you're like, oh, this is going to be good because of chassis. This is doing this or that. Like you said, there's so many mental nuances that go into all of this that I don't think people realize it. And that's why I wanted to put this show together, And that's why I do sincerely appreciate you sharing what's going on in, say, J Mart's head. So now you had a tremendous result at Daytona. You ended up, what, second or third there?
Yeah, I ended up second behind Eli.
Yeah, second behind Eli, which is pretty a statement all on its own. Here you are leading half the way through Daytona. Another statement, something that nobody can ever take away from you. How many rounds later was it that you hurt your back? It wasn't that long afterwards.
It was the outdoor season at Muddy Creek.
But that was what, only a couple months? It wasn't, yeah.
It was pretty early on in the series. I mean, wow. I think I had the red plate. And then my engine blew up on me at High Point.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't remember what round in the outdoor series that was, but it was fresh and early. And then, I ended up winning the first moto at Muddy Creek. Alex and I had just a hell of a battle and he ended up going down, but yeah, I got him. AP was back. And then I remember the gap from just the engine failure the weekend before. I closed the points gap big time. I'm like, ooh, I needed that.
Yes.
And then I just had a bad start. We put a new clutch in and it wasn't broken in right. And I just remember struggling with it on the line. And I just got a shitty jump and I was like, you gotta risk the biscuit here. Cause Muddy Creek's a tough track to pass on.
Sure.
And you can make a lot of passes if you're smart in lap one. And it didn't work out.
Well, I always say, and for anyone who's listened to our previous shows, you've heard me say this before, I believe moto is the quickest sadness to euphoria. If you remember the Billy Joel song, you know, sadness or euphoria, here you were, let's just say, was in March, right, at Daytona. You're like, holy smokes, I just led Daytona. I was able to hold off ET all the way to halfway point. I get second overall. My debut on a 450, pretty doggone good one. And then let's just say for sake of conversation, 6-8 weeks later, you're laying in the hospital. You're thankful you can move your toes. It's like the world just went through your fingers like sifting sifty sand. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Walk me through who's in your network from, okay, you've got this opportunity, 450, you did it and it went really well. How much did your network and your group of people change from that day at Daytona to when you're laying in the hospital?
Same group? Did people fly? They don't have time for this?
Yeah, like I think definitely like Lucas was there for a couple of days and then my mom ended up flying in. I think they had a race that weekend. She flew in. But then, there's definitely some people that came. Like I remember Eli came and visited me. My brother and some other people in the industry and stuff. And
yeah,
but everyone's kind of got a job to do, right? You know, and I was there in Bristol, Tennessee, I think for like 11 days in the hospital.
Because that's where the surgery went south, correct?
Yeah, the first one. Yeah. Just
okay. Yeah.
Wasn't good. And then, obviously they have to go to work, right?
Yeah.
They have to go to work. And I think, you know, over time, when you're no longer in the limelight, and I'm still on the mend trying to get healthy and I'm in my head because I'm not able to go out and do the one thing that made me feel confident and brought validation, right?
Sure.
I think over time you realize kind of who is there for you.
Is that absolutely.
You know what I mean? When the spotlight's not on you and you're not out there benefiting other people, whatever, who's calling you?
Yeah, I like the way you
said that. It's like when you're freshly retired.
Sure.
Who calls you?
Yeah. I like what you said when you're benefiting other people. That's very well said. Last question I have for you, and then we'll hit you with some rapid fire questions that we have some fun with. Walk us through anybody who's followed Lance Armstrong's career. You know, he was supposed to sign with the team. He gets diagnosed with these brain tumors. They literally came into his, you know, deathbed, as he called it, and pretty much told him, hey, we're pulling the contract. What was the contract? Because you were riding for Geico Honda when you got hurt. When did you know that there wasn't going to be a renewal? I guess, or maybe answer my own question. Was that because the Geico team essentially evaporated? Is that why the contract didn't come back around? Or was it because you got hurt?
No, I was actually, Geico was like family. I would have stayed with them had they not closed the doors.
Okay.
I actually had another deal signed the following year.
Okay. But that's only because they closed?
Well, they lost the title sponsor.
Right, right.
You know, so that was like a big thing, you know. But, you know, I was battling Dylan for the championship that year, and I ended up second outdoors.
Okay.
But Jet was going to stay.
Okay.
And I'm like, well, I just want to do my job. And I was so focused on trying to win that championship that I really wasn't out negotiating, because it kind of had me there thinking that maybe they might have something. Yeah. But I think it ended up being a deal to where it was like, hey, if you want Jet, you have to take Hunter as well.
Okay.
So that kind of really, what's that tell you? You know?
Yeah.
Popped out.
Yeah.
I got the call the night before the race day on Paula from a good friend. Yeah. That it was basically, we're done, you know?
The team itself was done, or your opportunity at Geico was done?
Well, the team was going to close. Geico was, yeah.
Right. I appreciate you sharing the emotional highs and lows in the roller coaster, because if you look at what you've just talked about over the last hour, things you can control, things you can't control, you're trying to do your job, not realizing that your team's title sponsor just got poached and then just sucked the necessary money out. You know, these are the things that I want the listeners to understand. Here you are as a professional athlete. You should be able to get up, ride, cross train, eat, sleep, repeat. And, you know, whether we get into the subject of agents, allows you to be able to focus on your job, teams not getting their sponsorship poached, like you said, going to a team where motor parts weren't going to be available till kind of late in the preseason, getting ready to go racing. Think about the mental angst that someone like Jeremy's going through constantly, trying to be the best athlete, but navigating parts and practice and travel and all that goes with it. So it's crazy. I've always wondered about, you know, again, from a spectator standpoint, we see the GoPro footage, Jay Coop looks over, you guys come together. And I'm thinking, and literally my flash brain was, wow, he just won almost won Daytona on a 450 program. Here we come to laid up back injury. I'd heard it had gotten infected. Team folds. Hey, good to be Jeremy Martin. Really? Really? You only remember when he had the 2 years back to back. Go talk to him now. Nobody's in the hospital room. Operation doesn't go perfect. Like you say, you went septic. Oh, now you want to be Jeremy, huh? Yeah. Not so quite glamorous and glorious anymore. So that's why I love to still see you smiling and not, you know, it's easy to get bitter, as you said earlier. I love the fact that you were able to come out of that.
I think it's a battle, right? Like, but later battle, right? Like, I'm sure you've, if we were to turn the camera around and talk to you about your story. I mean, I think aside from just racing, I think everybody in life, whether you race dirt bikes or you don't, you have to fight and things don't go the way you want it to. And you get some serious blows dealt to you, you know, and you just gotta, you know, I think that's the beauty of being fit, and it teaches you discipline. And there's times where you don't want to do things and you have to do it anyways. And I think that being fit and being in the gym and working out is a good thing for life. It's a good thing for life.
I totally agree with you. I have a mantra, you know, screw motivation, focus on discipline. Because discipline is when you don't want to do it, but you know it's got to get done. If you wait till you're motivated, it wanes like the wind. It can come and go in an instant, and it can evaporate and leave as quickly as it showed up. So
yeah,
it disciplined, and then the rest takes care of itself. Well, man, I appreciate it. We always end our show with some rapid fire questions. You ready for them? And by the way, all of our listeners know, just so if you're new to the show, Jeremy has no idea what these questions are. So it's not like they're all, in fact, our entire conversation is not pre-scripted at all. This is completely organic. So if we were to look in your phone, or you were to share a phone with us, in your opinion, who's the most influential person that you had in your phone for name and number?
That's a good question. I still look at my brother, you know. I look at my brother, I would say Eli. Yeah, I wouldn't be where I'm at today if it wasn't for Alex, for sure.
That's cool. This is the guy that was coming into the shop so angry, he's crying. Now here he is 20 years later saying he's still my best mentor. So props to Alex on that. And for those of you that don't know Alex, and you got to look him up. He's a class act all the way around. Who would you like to have in your phone that you don't?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think. I'm obviously kind of a little quiet and reserved, but I think it would be cool to, I don't know. Elon Musk.
Okay.
Let's go there. That'd be cool.
Yeah. what would be your first question for him if he was willing to take a call?
I guess just to say, just to, you know, I guess to ask him personally, like, you know, how do you do it, man? How do you do it? I mean, it's crazy, you know?
Absolutely. That is sort of true. Well, like he always says, he's not in the automobile industry. He's in the technology industry. And I think that shows you where his perspective is. I thought that was a pretty cool comment. What's your favorite food? What's your go-to food?
Yeah, I tell you what, I like a good steak.
Okay.
And as I say that, I also really like a good, I don't know, just some good old pasta. You can't go wrong with that, you know? I'd say one of the two, pasta, a good steak, and I don't know. Yeah.
There you go. What's your favorite splurge dessert?
Me? My favorite splurge dessert is probably a cookie, or I really like some dark chocolate.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love it. Who was your first non-moto childhood hero?
First non... that is another great question. I'm trying to think on that one. I mean, dude, I just remember... I'd say for me, it was Live or Die Moto. I remember, like, honestly, I got to say, like, my childhood, I guess, hero would be, you know, I looked up to my dad, and Carmichael was the man.
Yeah.
Carmichael was the man for me, dude. I remember just going to bed watching him dominate outdoors and being like, I don't care about Supercross. I want to be there for outdoors.
What'd you watch it on? Were you watching bar-to-bar DVDs or were you watching VHS tapes?
Just bar-to-bar DVD and all that kind of stuff. I didn't get too much in the tapes, I should say. But
Yeah. I just think it's cool for the listeners because, you know, people that are over 50 like me, we remember, you know, setting the VCR to record Moto World. It was a 30-minute little recap, you know, with Larry Myers and stuff. We've lived for that. And then you got the Cycle News, of course. And then when the bar-to-bar came out on DVD where you could just watch it, it never wore out. We thought we died and gone to Winter Park. And now kids are pissed if it doesn't instantly show up on their phone. So it's amazing how far we've come with getting race information. It's nuts. But, well, Jeremy, I just want to say thank you, man. Your story is just world-class, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts. If your schedule permits, I'd love to have you come on our Navigating Amateur Motocross. It's a show that me and Derek Harris with HP Development do where we try to talk to parents about how to navigate, you know, the big world of amateur motocross, and with you having so much experience and then with your family owning tracks and qualifiers and all. But for, you know, the listeners that enjoy this show, seeing how people have overcome and persevered, man, your story is amazing. And I really appreciate you sharing it. I'll give you the last say. Anybody you'd like to thank or anything you want to close up with?
Yeah, man, I just, you know, I look back at it now and I've worked with so many people. And I'm just grateful for everything, you know. I mean, there's people that I used to rely on back in the amateur ranks, you know, and it was different at the pro level and stuff. And now that I kind of look back and come full circle, I'm just grateful for everyone. And I, you know, I appreciate the time that they gave me. And, you know, I'm just grateful for it, you know. And I, you know, I may forget a couple people, but I like to think I remember everyone. And yeah, man, I just thank you.
It's awesome. Well, it's good to call you a friend. On behalf of all of our listeners, man, thank you so much. And best of luck in your next endeavor with Star.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Peace. Yeah.